You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 397, Revelation 21 and 22, part 2. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Well, I feel pretty good today, Trey, and you sound a little bit better. So I'm guessing you're going to say the same thing.
Yeah, I feel good. Yeah, I mean, I just can't get my voice. I don't know. I guess oxygen is important because I guess it's a big deal.
Key observation of the day.
Yeah, you got to have it. So at least I'm getting
deep,
it. So I'm
deep here. Thoughts. With Trey Strickland. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah. Perfect. But yeah, other than that, everything's good, man. I can't believe this is we made it. This is Revelation. I mean, this is it. This is the last part. I can't believe it's here. It's been a long journey and it's crazy. It's already here.
Believe it or not, it is here and it's yeah, no pun intended. You know, it almost takes your breath away that we actually made it.
Yeah, I'm so glad. I mean, it's like it's a huge deal, Mike. I mean, it's been a long journey to get here to the end of Revelation, and we said it'd take about a year, and it basically did. And
so, I wasn't like timing it out, but I was right.
Yeah,
so just occasionally that happens.
You know? We're just glad you decided to tackle Revelation because. I mean, it was such great content throughout this series, and, you know, it's just invaluable. So I want to say thank you on behalf of everybody. You know, thanks for, you know, first and foremost, thanks for everybody voting on it. You know, I forgot that people voted on it, so it kind of forced your hand to do it. But at least you put it up for a vote to tackle, and it's good stuff. It's invaluable material.
Yeah. Yeah, and I, you know, we both know it's generated a lot of questions, so we're not done with all that we would, you know, want to say about Revelation. We will be having follow-up Q&As, but yeah, it's a big deal to get through the whole book. This was a substantial book, to say the least.
Well, Mike, I'm ready. I'm ready to find out how this all ends, so please.
Yeah, so let's just get into our part two here, Revelation 21 and 22. This is the final part, the final installment. And again, we're looking at these two chapters and asking ourselves, you know, what parts of the Old Testament are important to John as he explains a vision or as he, you know, describes something that he's told, the content, of course, of what he's told and shown. How does that dip into the Old Testament? And how does the Old Testament provide a framework and really a place to begin to start thinking interpretively? And last time we you know, shot for the broader context, just the general notion in the prophets. We looked at Ezekiel, we looked at Isaiah, we looked at Jeremiah, we looked at Zechariah, that what the book of Revelation does with the new heaven, the new earth, the new Jerusalem, is it answers the expectation of a new temple with those things. And the Old Testament does that. The Old Testament overlaps these ideas. And so what we see in the book of Revelation isn't an anomaly or somehow John missing the mark. You know, we shouldn't be reading the end of the book of Revelation and asking, well, what happened to the temple? The Lord is the temple. Okay, God is the temple, as John explicitly says, you know, in these last two chapters. So this time, we're going to go through the chapters again and be a little more granular and look at some specific parts of both these chapters and what their Old Testament orientation is. So to begin, I'm just going to read quickly through Revelation 21, and then we will jump in and pick our spots as we are accustomed to doing in this series. So Revelation 21, I'm reading from ESV. John writes, "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them and they will be his people, and God himself will be with them as their God. And he will wipe away every tear from their eyes. Death shall be no more, neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain any more, for the former things have passed away. And he who was seated on the throne said, Behold, I am making all things new. Also he said, Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true. And he said to me, It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give from the spring of the water of life without payment. The one who conquers will have this heritage, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. But as for the cowardly, the faithless, the detestable, as for murderers, the sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars, their portion shall be in the lake of fire, or the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, which is the second death. Then came one of the seven angels, who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues, and spoke to me, saying, Come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great high mountain, and showed me the holy city Jerusalem coming down out of heaven from God, having the glory of God, its radiance, like a most rare jewel, like a jasper, clear as crystal. It had a great high wall with 12 gates, and at the gates 12 angels, and on the gates the names of the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel were inscribed. On the east 3 gates, on the north 3 gates, on the south 3 gates, and on the west 3 gates. And the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them were the 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. And the one who spoke with me had a measuring rod of gold to measure the city and its gates and walls. The city lies 4 square, its length the same as its width, and he measured the city with his rod 12,000 stadia, or stadia. Its length and width and height are equal. He also measured its wall, 144 cubits by human measurement, which is also an angel's measurement. The wall was built of jasper, while the city was pure gold like clear glass. The foundations of the wall of the city were adorned with every kind of jewel. The first was jasper, the second sapphire, the third agate, the fourth emerald, the fifth onyx, the sixth carnelian, the seventh chrysolite, the eighth beryl, the ninth topaz, the tenth chrysoprase, the 11th jacinth, and the 12th amethyst. And the 12 gates were 12 pearls, each of the gates made of a single pearl, and the city, street of the city was pure gold, like transparent glass. And I saw no temple in the city, for its temple is the Lord God the Almighty and the Lamb, and the city has no need of sun or moon to shine on it, for the glory of God gives it light, and its lamp is the Lamb. By its light will the nations walk, and the kings of the earth will bring their glory into it, and its gates will never be shut by day, and there will be no night there. They will bring into it the glory and honor of the nations, but nothing unclean will ever enter it, nor anyone who does what is detestable or false, but only those who are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. That's Revelation 21, you know, and even as you read through that, you get a few interesting little tidbits that, you know, we may or may not say much about, but just popped into my head here, this whole thing about nothing unclean will ever enter it. That pretty much covers a question like, well, will there be sin, you know, in the new earth, and will there be rebellion? No, I mean, the text is pretty clear. There are other reasons, of course, to doubt the utter implausibility of that. But there are a lot of things in this chapter like that that answer some of these nagging questions, and just, you know, just give it a close reading and some of these things become apparent. But what's less apparent is where we're going to live today. And that is, what are the Old Testament counterparts or antecedents to this? Now, we already noted in the first 5 verses, really Revelation 21, verse 1 and verse 5, the description about the new heaven, new earth, the former things won't be remembered, the new earth will remain forever, you know, in contrast to the old, and so on and so forth. We already talked about how Isaiah 65 and 66 were really influential in those, you know, in that whole description. So I'm not going to repeat that. I'm going to go on to the phrase, no more sea. And I've alluded to this in a number of podcast episodes. This is sort of a favorite verse of mine, because the sea is a very well-known chaos metaphor from the Old Testament, because the sea was to be feared. It was untamable. It was unpredictable. It was hostile to life. You know, humans can't live in or, you know, in the sea. All these things, you know, the Leviathan, the dragon, all these symbols and metaphors that are operative in relation to the sea sort of come to a climax here when John says, well, in the new creation, the sea is no more. And it doesn't mean, you know, an overly literalistic, well, I guess there's no salt water. You know, no, that's just ridiculous. And I think, you know, even the most literalistic sort of bent in interpretation, I would hope would recognize kind of the absurdity of that approach when it comes to just this one line. But there's so much else in the content of these verses that, again, defy a literalistic interpretation. And you miss the things that transcend this sort of out-of-the-box literalistic approach. So no more sea. I'm going to read a little bit from DBI, which, again, is a resource I highly recommend, one of my most frequently recommended, the Dictionary of Biblical Imagery. This is essential. It's just a one-volume reference work, but it's essential for Bible study, in my view. DBI has this as part of its entry on the sea. There are two aspects of this reversal, the defeat of evil and the triumph of the good. You know, it's being described in the apocalypse and here in Revelation. Jeremiah 4:23-28 portrays the uncreation of the world that reverses the creation story of Genesis 1. So when the sea is unleashed, you know, the sea is sort of at the end of Genesis 1. There's this tension about how everything is good, but it's not optimal. The whole world isn't Eden, and chaos is being restrained. Well, eventually that's going to give way, and we get, you know, this chaotic decreation sort of language elsewhere in the Bible. And DBI goes on, he says, 2 Peter gives us a vision of a complete dissolution followed by the assertion, but according to his promise, we wait for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. Revelation 21 uses similar imagery, drawing explicit attention to the absence of death and mourning and crying and pain. Those things are no more because the former things have passed away. In Revelation 21:4, we get that line. We get it elsewhere. Again, back into the Old Testament, Isaiah, and everything is made new. In the new universe, there will be no more sea, Revelation 21:1, a reference to the final triumph over evil and chaos, which is often pictured in the Bible as a sea monster, such as the dragon in Job 7:12, Psalm 74:13, or Leviathan, Psalm 74:13-14, Rahab or Rahab in Psalm 89:10, Isaiah 51, and the serpent in Isaiah 27:1, just for example. So, the line that there's no more sea, a Jewish reader, someone, you know, acquainted with the Old Testament, whether they were Jew or Gentile, whether they're reading, you know, Hebrew or Aramaic or the Septuagint, they're going to know what the sea means, what the sea is in Old Testament thought. And when John says that the sea is no more, they understand that completely. Again, in this place, the new restored global Eden and everything else that has preceded the fallenness of it all has passed away. No more sea means there's no more chaos. There's no more enemy. There's no more sin. There's no more death, suffering, all these things. It's over. It's over. So with one line, you know, just a few words, and of course focused on the sea, the Old Testament context makes it crystal clear what John is suggesting here. So here we have in Isaiah a reference to, again, the city, the New Jerusalem, as the holy city. I mean, think about that. We're reading in Isaiah, you know, in the previous episode, a lot of the language about temple consciousness, there were two sides of that coin. Jerusalem and the temple were going to get destroyed because of idolatry, and they're going to be replaced. Okay. Well, a lot of that was from Isaiah, really Isaiah 40 through 66, and specifically 65 and 66. Well, here we are in Isaiah 52. And the prophet is calling Jerusalem the holy city. Now, in real time, that didn't make much sense because Jerusalem's going to be judged. But nevertheless, again, it hints at Israel's future, specifically Jerusalem's future. Everything is going to be restored. And, you know, we get this categorical language. There shall no more come into you the uncircumcised and the unclean. You're going to be a holy city. So the language here John uses comes from right out of the Old Testament. We have a reference in Isaiah 61:10. We could look at Isaiah 62. Again, the Old Testament is John's source book. If you go through and you keep reading in Revelation 21, once you hit verse 9, in fact, Revelation 21, 9 through chapter 22, verse 5, all of that is going to be in some way related to what we talked about in the last episode, the restoration, this expectation of the restoration of a temple, but how that works out in fulfillment terms in a new city and a new creation. And all of that in turn gets a lot of its imagery from Ezekiel 40 through 48, which is Ezekiel's big temple vision. And one of the key verses on that, I'm just going to mention this because this is going to be a touch point for a lot in Revelation 21, believe it or not, is Ezekiel 43:7. So this is in the section of Ezekiel, you know, the famous temple vision. And in the middle of that, we've got sort of an obscure verse. So I wanted to mention Ezekiel 43:7 because this is the part of the big temple vision where the glory of the Lord comes back. Okay, so there's this big reversal theme going on. So I'm just going to start at the very first verse, and we'll hit verse 7 because that actually pops up in a number of places in Revelation 21. He led me to the gate facing east. So the prophet is led by this man in linen, this guide. Behold, the glory of the God of Israel was coming from the east, and the sound of his coming was like the sound of many waters. And the earth shone with his glory, and the vision I saw was just like the vision that I had seen when he came to destroy the city, and just like the vision that I had seen by the Kivar Canal, and I fell on my face. As the glory of the Lord entered the temple by the gate facing east, the Spirit lifted me up and brought me into the inner court, and behold, the glory of the Lord filled the temple. While the man was standing beside me, I heard one speaking to me out of the temple. And here's verse 7. He said to me, Son of man, this is the place of my throne, and the place of the soles of my feet, where I dwell in the midst of the people of Israel forever. And the house of Israel shall no more defile my holy name, neither they nor their kings, by their whoring and by the dead bodies of their kings at their high places. Now, I bring this up because if you look at that verse, it's part of the temple vision of Ezekiel. Yes, we talked about this last time, the expectation of a new temple. But this verse that's talking about a temple is going to get cited in Revelation 21 and 22 a few times, not in relationship to a temple, because there is no temple, according to Revelation 21, 22. It's going to get cited in relationship to the new city and the new creation. And if you look at the content, God says to Ezekiel, this is the place of my throne and the place of the soles of my feet. Now that's language. The throne, remember the Ark of the Covenant, the cherubim throne, at one point also called the footstool of the Lord. We expect that to be in a temple, but in Revelation it's not. It's the city itself. Okay, there is no temple. The Lord is the temple. Christ is the temple. So this verse, again, takes a temple expectation. And the way John uses it is not of a temple, but of a city. And again, really of Zion, just generally, and a new earth. So this is going to come up in a number of places. And I just want to fix it in your head as we go through here. Ezekiel 43:7 gets fulfilled in Revelation 21, and the fulfillment is not a new temple. The fulfillment is a new city and a new earth. Now, Beale and McDonough, again, in the commentary on the New Testament use of the old, and they did the Revelation portion. They write this in response to this little section of Revelation 21. In the light of the following references to the Ezekiel 40 through 48 temple, specifically Revelation 21:9, all the way into chapter 22. This is when we get all that jewelry, the gemstone imagery, you know, this temple imagery. In light of all that, they say, the promise in Ezekiel 43:7 is echoed and fulfilled in 21:1-3. The end time temple would be where God will dwell. The Greek term there is katasgenose. he will dwell among the sons of Israel forever. That is also a citation of Leviticus 26, 11 and 12, and Ezekiel 37, 26 through 28. Why is that important? Because if we went back and read Ezekiel 26, 11 and 12, this is a statement uttered to Israelites about dwelling in the land of Israel, in the land of Canaan. But in Revelation, it's not just uttered to Israelites, it's uttered to all those who have overcome. This is after the second coming. This is after the day of the Lord. This is after the great white throne judgment. I mean, every believer, Jew or Gentile, is going to be in the place where the Lord dwells. So we have, again, this circumcision-neutral body, one people of God, that all of this applies to. And God says, I'm going to dwell with them and they're going to be my people. So we have this promise given to Old Testament Israel transferred over to every believer in the book of Revelation. It's explicit. It's very clear. So again, we don't want to lose sight of that. The term here is interesting, though. Kata skenose. There's a verb, a verbal root form here, skenao, which means, sounds like skin, but it means to tabernacle or to dwell. The idea of tabernacling among men, tabernacling among people. Now, we can see that clearly from the tabernacle because God was, you know, present with the Ark of the Covenant and it would be transported. You have the pillar of the cloud, pillar of fire. We have all this Old Testament imagery that telegraph, you know, the fact that God was with Israel. He's with the camp. He's leading them to the promised land. Again, this is all familiar stuff. But the notion of tabernacling, again, with people, is a very Old Testament Israelitish time of Moses sort of statement. You know where else we see this? Not only just in Revelation 21, but we see this language in John chapter 1, where it says the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. In Greek, it's this verb. The Word became flesh and tabernacled among us. Skenao, again, to tabernacle. It's a way of telegraphing, again, the body of Christ is the dwelling place of God. We see that in the incarnation with Jesus. And we also see it with the church, because the church is the body of Christ. And here we go again, getting the same language in Revelation 21. It's inescapable, is what I'm trying to telegraph here. It's just, this is how the text wants us to think about these Old Testament promises and one people of God. If you go to Revelation 21:4, again, we're just going to pick our way through the chapters here and just take notice of this or that, you know, thing that's kind of interesting in light of its Old Testament context. But if we go to Revelation 21:4, he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore. The former things are passed away. Again, that line is also a specific fulfillment of prophecy from Isaiah 25:8, which says, again, the Lord God has taken away every tear from every face. It was also echoed earlier in Revelation 7 about those who are. Revelation 7 is one of the passages about the 144,000. We talked about, are these just Jews? Are they Jewish Christians? Is it every Christian? And you know, you could argue a number of different ways, but you can't exclude, if we look at it that way, we can't exclude certain believers from this picture. So here again, we have language from Revelation 7 brought back into Revelation 21 about taking away every tear from every face. And it's a fulfillment of a prophecy given in Isaiah to Israelites, but here it's given to everybody, every believer. Isaiah 35:10, Isaiah 51:11 predict pain and grief and groaning will have fled away. Again, at this time of the future, you know, the new earth, the future creation, the recreation. Again, there's a whole list of promises, here's the point, given in the Old Testament to Israelites, because that's the focus of the picture in the Old Testament, those in covenant, you know, with God through Abraham and, you know, the Mosaic law, they're Israelites, okay? But the way these promises work out are not just to the Jew only, they are to all believers in the book of Revelation. Everything comes full circle. you keep reading in the book of Revelation, you hit this list of gems, okay, which is, you know, kind of long and tedious, but the temple description starts in verse 9. In Revelation 21, we have the angel who had the seven bowls, and he says, come, I'll show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. Well, let's just hit that one first, the bride, the wife of the Lamb. Again, that's an interesting phrase. It has an Old Testament context. Even the description of that follows it in verse 10, he carried me away in the spirit to a great high mountain and showed me the holy city Jerusalem coming down out of heaven from God. This notion of portraying the new city, the new Jerusalem, on a very high mountain, did you catch that? Why are mountains significant? I mean, Mount Zion isn't that high. If you've ever been to Israel, you know this. I mean, it's certainly higher than Megiddo, which doesn't have a mountain. You know, we argued that when we talked about Armageddon, that this is not about Megiddo. It's about Jerusalem. At least you get Mount Zion there, but it's not very high. Why the language? Because it's the cosmic mountain. It's the place where God dwells. He's just told you earlier in the chapter, Revelation 21. Okay, I'm going to tabernacle with them. They're going to be my people. I'm their God. They're my people. Wherever God is his home, is his throne. And John is using this great high mountain language, again, to remind us of the theology that's packed into mountains, the theology that's packed into, again, the cosmic mountain of the Old Testament. The first cosmic mountain was what? Eden. You say, well, Eden's just a garden. No, it's also called a mountain in Ezekiel 28. Again, this is well-worn territory for those of you who have read Unseen Realm. But it's Eden. That should be no surprise because the New Jerusalem, the new creation, is going to be described in Edenic terms. This is all intentional on John's part. He wants us to be thinking in light of Old Testament theology about these things. He's well beyond literal geography. He's well beyond a building project. He's doing Old Testament theology to telegraph important messages, namely that in the end, every way that humanity is cursed and has cursed itself and has been cursed by supernatural powers on the outside is going to be reversed. There is no estrangement from God. There is no divided family of God. There are no Jews and Gentiles. There's one people of God. This is what God wants. It's the way things were in Eden to begin with, and that's the way it's going to wind up. That's the way it's going to end. There's no more fragmentation. There's no depravity. And so all these other rebellions, we've got Genesis 3, Genesis 6, and then the Babel episode, they're all reversed. And the way you telegraph a complete reversal is to go back to the original cosmic mountain, the original Eden, and start talking about it in those terms. And this is what John's doing as he goes into this description. Again, it's if you're aware of the Old Testament images and what they mean, these things are just going to jump out at you. Now, Beale and McDonough write this of verses 9 and 10. They write, in Revelation 21:10, we have a combination of Ezekiel 43:5, the Spirit took me up, and Ezekiel 40 verses 1 through 2, the hand of the Lord was upon me and brought me and set me on a very high mountain. Again, Ezekiel 40 verses 1 through 2 is what? It's the beginning of the temple section of Ezekiel. But when you get to Revelation 21, is he talking about a temple? No. He's talking about a city and a new creation. And that's okay because all those things are where God tabernacles, where God lives, and where God lives is the cosmic mountain. Everything comes full circle. Everything is tightly related to everything else. It's just we can't see it because we're not used to Old Testament thinking mode when it comes to these metaphors. Okay, we miss what's being telegraphed if we don't know that. So again, Beale and McDonough say it comes from these two passages. This combination indicates beyond doubt that the following vision in Revelation 21:10 through 22:5 is to be identified with the prophetic culmination of the blissful vision of the future temple in Ezekiel 40 through 48, which was located on, quote, a very high mountain. Again, the language is the same. John wants you, when John is writing Revelation 21, 9 and 10, which doesn't include a temple. He wants you to think about Ezekiel 40 through 48, which is about a temple. You say, how in the world does this work? It works if you think of the cosmic mountain instead of a literal building project. Then it works. Then you can understand it. Back to Beale and McDonough, they say the angel transports John to a great and high mountain, where also the new city temple is likely located, since Old Testament prophecy, you know, in other passages, understood the coming Jerusalem to be situated on a high mountain. You get it in Isaiah 2, 2 and 3, Isaiah 4, 1 through 5, Isaiah 25, 6 through 26, 2. You get it in Micah 4, 1 through 2, and, you know, an assortment of other passages, including Second Temple Lit that I'm not going to recite to you here. When you get into the description, the gemstones, this is verses 11 through 21 of Revelation 21. Again, this ought to be familiar to those of you who have read Unseen Realm, but the stones, the gemstones here that are used to describe this, the new city, the Edenic creation, the Edenic new city here, all those gemstones are present in Ezekiel 28, where they do not refer to the gems on the high priest's ephod. I mean, practically everybody says that, but if you compare the list of Ezekiel 28, which I do in Unseen Realm, with the list of the high priest's garment, guess what? The lists do not match. There's a better match. Rather, the stones are ways of describing the splendor of the place, not a person, the high priest, but the place in view, which is God's cosmic abode. Not, again, has nothing to do with a specific man. So I'm going to read a little bit from Unseen Realm where we got into this a little bit, just so that you get the flavor for, again, where I'm going here. I wrote, all the stones in Ezekiel 28:13, except for one, are used elsewhere to describe the supernatural Jerusalem in Revelation 21, which is obviously the divine abode and the throne room. This is entirely consistent with the portrayal of divinity in terms of luminescence, things that shine, okay? The lone exception is the Septuagint's Anthrax, which is the Greek rendering of the term Tarshish in Ezekiel 28:13. That word, Anthrax, is used elsewhere in Ezekiel to describe the divine throne, Ezekiel 10:9, as well as in Isaiah to describe the New Jerusalem, Isaiah 54:11. Readers who check the Greek closely may presume a point of incongruence with one other item in the Septuagint rendering of Ezekiel 28:13. Anukion, Greek term for Hebrew, Barakat, is not found in Revelation 21. The supposed discrepancy is a misperception, though. The word Anukion is a kind of onyx, which is a gem. We get that from Lydell Scott in his lexicon, very well-known Greek lexicon. Instead of Anukion, in Revelation 21, we get sardonyx. Both terms, though, are used to describe the same gem in the ancient world. They're used to describe, again, a type of onyx. And I, you know, again, the list, what I'm trying to say here is that the list in Revelation 21 of the gems is entirely consistent, not partly, but entirely consistent with the description in Ezekiel 28, where what is being described is not a person, the high priest, it's a place. And the place is Eden. Remember Ezekiel 28, the chapter that describes Eden as the garden of God and the mountain of God. He's describing Eden. So it's very, we would of course expect John to talk about the new Jerusalem and the new earth in Edenic terms. And he knows what he's doing. It fits, it's coherent, it's congruent. And unfortunately, you don't hear it that much because everybody's stuck on the high priest in Ezekiel 28, and he's not the point. Now, Beale, in his Revelation commentary, has this to say about this section. Old Testament prophecy asserted that the end time city of God and its temple would be set on a high mountain. Okay, so he gives a few passages in Micah 4, Isaiah 2, Isaiah 4, Isaiah 25, a few of these, and some from Jubilees and Enoch. And specifically with Enoch, I thought I found this one interesting. First Enoch 24 and 25 asserts that the high mountain, which excelled all others, is God's latter-day throne. So Enoch's tracking on the same thing too. Okay. His throne is on a tree with, that has fruit for food for the elect to grow. Again, we're getting into the garden description now of Eden. Both tree and throne are located in the temple. And if you go back and you look at these passages, and if you look at Revelation 21, Ezekiel 28, 14 and 16 says that the first Garden of Eden was also on a mountain that contained these precious stones. Again, so it isn't, you know, just Mike saying this. I mean, that other scholars have noticed this very, very transparently. The city, the holy Jerusalem, is described as having the glory of God and her luminary like a precious stone. As a jasper stone shining like crystal, continues the allusion to Ezekiel 43. There also the prophet says that he saw the glory of God coming into the new temple, and the earth shone like radiant light from the glory round about. Again, all of this imagery is, it's repetitive. Isaiah, Ezekiel, Revelation, you know, Revelation 21. It's all using this gemstone, this luminous description of the same place, wherever God is. And in Ezekiel's reference, it's Eden. And of course, it's going to be the same reference for John. The new city and the new earth get described in Edenic terms. What about the walls? What about the walls? It's the other thing that sort of sticks out with the description of the new city. So you have the gemstones that point back again to Eden. Keener, in his commentary, I think has some interesting things here to say about the walls. He says, some Jewish traditions spoke of 12 gates of heaven. Specifically, that's 1 Enoch 33 through 36 and 72 through 82. So Enoch is full of this kind of language that we get in the book of Revelation. The gates here in Revelation represent the 12 tribes of Israel. And again, those are listed in Ezekiel 48. 31 and 34. So again, we have another element of the big famous temple prophecy, but here in Revelation, they're not used of a temple, they're used to describe a city. John's New Jerusalem resembles some other Jews' visions of the new temple. The Qumran temple scroll is an example he cites, except that earlier in his book, in Revelation, he incorporated all believers in Jesus into the heritage of these tribes. That's Revelation 7, 4 through 9. In biblical tradition, 12 stones pointed to the 12 tribes, Joshua 4, 3 through 9. In the high priest's breastplate, in Exodus 28, 17 to 21, they are specifically inscribed with the names of the tribes. Here's another sort of connection, but also a disconnection. Here, however, the foundation stones refer to the 12 apostles. Again, you see how easily something assigned to Israel, something assigned to the tribes, gets applied to the apostles. You know, this relationship between Israel and the church comes out again. Here, however, the foundation stones refer to the 12 apostles of the Lamb, in keeping with the Christian image of the new temple's true foundations. Although Jesus is our ultimate foundation, 1 Corinthians 3:11, early Christian tradition already emphasized that the church was built on the foundation of apostles and prophets who revealed Jesus' message. So again, we get the same kind of beginning with Israel and winding up, you know, with the church. Again, the circumcision neutral one people of God, as we do before. How about the shape and the dimensions? Because there's some really spectacular, and I don't know what the best way to describe these things, you know, would be other than sort of defying literalism. And we'll get into a little bit here why. But as far as the shape and descriptions, again, Keener has some interesting thoughts there too. So I'm going to read what he says in his commentary. The measuring rod, Revelation 21:15, is an important stage device that allows John to recognize the supernatural enormity of the city in verse 16. It recalls the measuring of Jerusalem in Zechariah 2:1-2, or the temple in Ezekiel 40-41 in the Hebrew Bible, and reminds John's oppressed audience that the persecuted remnant, whose measuring began in Revelation 11:1-2, is the prototype for the glorious future city. Ezekiel's New Jerusalem was 18,000 cubits all around. John's is nearly 2,000 times larger. Okay, did you catch that? The temple that Ezekiel describes in Ezekiel 40-48 is 18,000 cubits all around. The one that you get here in the book of Revelation is 2,000 times that size. The symbolic numbers portray this city as the dwelling of God's people. Look at the numbers, 12,000 stadia, and 144, the cubits, again in Revelation 21, 16 and 17, both recall the number of God's servants earlier in the book, you know, the 144,000, 12,000 times 12, you know. Again, you just do the math. The numbers are being reused again to speak what? To speak of a literal building? No, it's to speak of the people of God, because the temple, there is no temple. The temple is the body of Christ, and the body of Christ is believers. Again, all these ideas come together. They converge again. The square shape of the city, Keener writes, in 21:16, fits some ancient building plans. Walls in Syria-Palestine were generally irregular because of the uneven topography, in contrast to more level land in Egypt and Babylonia. The New Jerusalem differs in this way from the Old Jerusalem as well. But while this background plays an important part, the New Jerusalem is not merely square. It's cubic. It's a cube. Despite the utter incongruity with all human imagination of a city 1,500 miles high. Okay, what's being described in the book of Revelation would be a city that's 1,500 miles high. And this defies literalism, to be blunt about it. Thus, most of all the shape recalls the most holy place. If you actually look at the cubic size and the way it's referred to, again, the city gets referred to as temple. Well, guess what you have in proportion, in ratio proportion? You have the most holy place of the old temple. Not only will God live with his people in Jerusalem, Revelation 21:3, Keener says, not only will the entire city be like a temple, but it will be like the most holy place in its shape. Again, that's not an accident. It's deliberate. And Keener writes, it is thus not surprising that the city does not need a temple other than the Lord himself, Revelation 21:22. Believers will experience God's presence in its full intensity as never before. If the church is a temple already, Ephesians 2:18 through 22 says that, our future experience is like the holiest part of the temple, inviting continual worship and enjoyment of God's presence. The dimensions of the city are supernatural, he continues, contrasting starkly with the pretensions of the doomed great city Babylon earlier in the book. Technically, a wall 72 yards, 65 meters high, or even thick, Revelation 21:16, would prove utterly inadequate to protect a city 1,500 miles high. Now, did you catch that? Here's an element that very clearly defies the literalism of it. So if the city is 1,500 miles high, the walls that are supposed to be protecting the city are only 65 meters high. What good are the walls? Again, if there's some literalistic purpose here, what... You got like 1% of the place protected. It just doesn't make any sense. But the purpose of the numbers, again, Keener writes, is not literal so much as to emphasize the city's future glory and to suggest that when history is complete, God's remnant through the ages will not prove as small as it now appears to persecuted churches of John's generation. The height is the most dramatic feature, perhaps even more so for modern readers who recognize, people like us, we know this is true. We recognize that even at less than 6 miles above sea level, at the top of Mount Everest, you can't breathe. If the point of this is a literal structure and it's going to be our home, well, most of it we can't even visit because we'll die. Because we can't get oxygen. Again, it just makes no sense at all. But the numbers going back to the temple dimensions, the dimensions of the most holy place, going back to the people of God, those who are marked, the 144,000, and again, all these indications through the numbers and the measurements and the gemstones and whatnot, the whole point is that this is about a place, and this place is where God has chosen to tabernacle forever. And this place where God tabernacles is where you're going to tabernacle. He will be your God. You will be his people forever. It's as simple as that. You know, I say simple because it is simple if you're aware of the imagery. It's not simple if you're not, because then you come up with these bizarre, well, maybe the New Jerusalem is like a UFO mothership or something, you know, and we invent science fiction-esque ways of reading the Book of Revelation when that just is not in view at all. Again, when we're stuck with only one approach and we have to use that approach, we produce bizarre sorts of things like that. And what I'm suggesting to you is that, you know, we shouldn't be doing that. We should be looking at, again, how this passage and its description continually go back to Eden, this perfect paradise, trying to use the imagery of the old temple and Eden, the old Eden, and the people of God and the priesthood, and trying to use all these images to get you to realize that at the end, we're all going to be living in God's house where he has chosen to tabernacle and be his people. And that's really the point. That's the point to begin. Another interesting thing here, the walls. Why does Jerusalem need a wall in the eternal era of peace anyway? And Keener writes, certainly the purpose is not to keep anybody out, since, quote, Revelation 21:25, no one will ever close its gates. Again, this literalistic thinking, you know, raises this question, and it's actually answered in that verse. Nobody's ever going to close its gates. There's no need to. It doesn't need protection. It doesn't need protection from defilement. Nothing unclean will ever go into it. Again, we read that earlier in the episode, reading through the passage. Nor is the description of the walls perfectly literal, Keener says. But ancient cities of substantial size always had walls, so one is needed here in the description of the greatest of cities. Otherwise, it would be perceived as something missing, is his point. Further, if there were no walls, there would be no description of the gates. Okay, gates provided cities in Asia Minor and elsewhere the best opportunities to flaunt imperial triumphant architecture. Without these gates, Revelation would miss an opportunity to reapply biblical symbolism in its specifically Christocentric way, and also loop it in the tribes and the apostles. Angelic measurements mentioned in 21:17 are also human measurements. The verse specifically says that. So it must mean normal angels, not those of extraordinary size. The human measurement here explicitly recalls Ezekiel 40, verse 5. But Bauckham argues that it is simultaneously offering a vivid contrast to Revelation 13:18. That's the number of the beast. The number of a human who is a beast versus the measurements of a human that is also angelic. I kind of like that turn of phrase on Keener's part. He says, I'll read it again. Bauckham argues that it simultaneously offers a vivid contrast to Revelation 13:18, where the number of a human who is a beast versus the measurements of a human here that is are also angelic, are contrast. The beast kingdom debases humanity to a beastly level, whereas the New Jerusalem raises it to an angelic level. Revelation 21:22, again, just keep going through the passage. This is the verse where, again, very plainly, I saw no temple, John says. Beal and McDonough get into this, some of what we've already covered, so I don't want to cover it again. But they offer this, which is kind of interesting. So I'll just add this one little bit. John says, I saw no temple in the New Jerusalem. It is not that John saw no temple at all, but only that he saw no material temple, like Israel's old temple. And it defies the expectation. The reason that he saw no material temple, or no literal temple in the city, is that the Lord God, the Almighty, and the Lamb are its temple, its sanctuary, and the Greek word is naos. Or more precisely, God and the Lamb have filled the entire new creation with their glorious presence, a glorious presence formerly sequestered in the Holy of Holies and in the heavenly temple. This is why the New Jerusalem is portrayed as a cube, since that was the shape of the Holy of Holies in Israel's former temple. And now God's glorious presence, formerly limited to the back room of the temple, has burst forth and filled the entire cosmos. I thought that was well said in that little section there. Now, again, we could go off and talk about, you know, the worldwide, you know, encompassing nature of the temple. And there was this inordinately literalistic defying description of a temple, you know, 1500 miles high and all this kind of stuff. This is known elsewhere in Second Temple Jewish literature, where you'd get these, you know, crazy enormous, you know, dimensions of the temple, because they wanted to compare the dwelling place of God at the end of days as filling the entire cosmos. And this is one of the ways you do it. You do it with something so inordinately large as to be physically impossible to communicate the point that God tabernacles everywhere. Okay, he's not picking his spots anymore. He fills everything. So Josephus had one of these, you know, kinds of descriptions. And if you were going through either Beale's commentary or Beale and McDonough in the commentary on the use of the old in the new, you know, you'd get the references. But Josephus has, you know, this sort of description. Josephus writes that the earth, you know, was the outer court and the sea was the inner court. And, you know, he tries to map over, you know, parts of the planet to the temple, again, an inordinately large temple, again, just to communicate this idea that the Lord fills everywhere. Philo did it as well, that the temple was a microcosm of the universe and all this sort of thing. I mean, this is not unknown. You will get it in books outside of Revelation. But again, the point, regardless of what the system is, the point is the same, that the Lord's presence fills everything. There is no place that you could go where he is not there. Now, we know that theologically now, but at the end of days with the new earth and the new Jerusalem, you know, if you'll pardon the expression, it's going to be more literalistically true. I mean, you're going to witness it. You're going to be able to sense it. You're going to be able to see it with your eyes and sense it with your other senses, that there's no place you can go where the presence of God is not felt, seen, heard, and otherwise. And that's what they're trying to get at here. Let's jump into Revelation 22 for a few minutes as we wrap up the book. In Revelation 22, verse 1, we read the following. Just going to pick a few passages here. Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb through the middle of the street of the city, also on either side of the river, the tree of life with its 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit each month, and the leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. That was actually the first two verses. But again, you get the idea. When we get into 22, Beale and McDonough write this. The opening verse of chapter 22 combines the prophetic pictures of a spring or a river of quote-unquote living water flowing out of the latter-day Jerusalem. And then they cite Zechariah 14:8 for the image, and also Ezekiel 47:1-9. So we're back in Ezekiel 47 again. They continue, the introductory verse of chapter 22 reaches further back even than the Old Testament prophecies of Ezekiel, though. Older than Ezekiel, Joel, and Zechariah, to the description of the primeval garden in Genesis, specifically Genesis 2:10, where we read, quote, a river was going forth from Eden, unquote. And living water going forth, a river was going forth. So he's saying the Genesis Eden description is part of the backdrop here. And they continue, in association with the first Eden's river, we have a comment that the gold and the bdellium and the onyx stone were features around one of the river's tributaries, which compares to the precious stones surrounding the river of Revelation 22:1. We just read about those gems and others in Revelation 21:18-21. The point is that God will, quote, make the end like the beginning. They cite the Epistle of Barnabas there in an early Christian text. Though the consummated garden will exist on an escalated scale in comparison to the first, as in Ezekiel 47, the living water flows from the temple, though now God and the Lamb are the temple. Although the Holy Spirit may be in mind, the water metaphorically primarily represents the life of eternal fellowship with God and Christ, which is born out of the way, or which is born out by way of Revelation 22:3-5, and develops in Revelation 22:1-2. And then they cite here, they make the side note that water is used in the Old Testament and in broader Judaism and the New Testament as a symbol of the Holy Spirit. For example, Ezekiel 36, 25 through 27, John 3, 5, John 4, 10 through 24, 1 John 5, 7 and 8, and then a few, they cite a Qumran text, 1 QS 4, 21. This notion of living water takes us back to the, you know, living water is water that moved as opposed to something stagnant or like a pond. Okay, that's what living water was perceived to be. It had movement, just like living things, you know, did elsewhere. They moved, showed they were alive. So living water is the expression. In this instance, we need to think of it more abstractly as the water that comes from where the source of life is. And the source of life is where God tabernacles, where he is, because he is the source of all life. And so it goes back to Eden, gets brought into the new creation in Revelation 21 and 22. Again, to convey the same ideas, everything has gone full circle back to Eden, where there will be no more want, and no more famine, no more drought, no more disease, no more, you know, fill in the blank. It's all going to be what Eden was meant to be. In verses 2 and 3, there On draws attention to the line about the middle of the street. The phrase, through the middle of the street of the city, also on either side of the river, the tree of life. That whole kind of jumbled, it's kind of awkward syntactically, but you get a reference to the middle of the street, and then you get a reference to either side of the river, and then one tree of life. Like, what do we do with that? Well, the answer is it's best interpreted as a collective reference. That is, many trees of life. Think of the garden of Eden. Okay, there are many trees that are in view because you can't have one tree of life on both sides of a river. So he grammatically he shows other examples of how the word for tree is used as a collective to denote a forest or more than one tree. We're not going to worry about that level of detail, but again, just so that you're aware that again this is how these few verses need to be approached so that they make sense. Now, On writes this. He says, ultimately, this is an allusion to Ezekiel 47:12. And here we go back to Ezekiel 47 again. And it's continued in verses 2, you know, throughout verse 2. And the verse 2 is different parts. So Ezekiel 47:12 is a source text, which the author has subtly modified by changing all kinds of trees. That's what you'd read in the Septuagint. On both sides of the river flowing from the sanctuary mentioned in Ezekiel 47:7-12 to the collective term Zulon Zoes, which is tree of life, but could also be translated trees of life. The term Zulon is a collective referring to numerous trees found along both banks of the river. And again, he has his own, you know, grocery list of where this occurs elsewhere. What about the fruit? Okay, so we've got more than just one tree of life. We've got an abundant garden. And think of the Garden of Eden, back in Ezekiel 32, I believe, the thing with the trees in the Garden of Eden as well. It could be part of this whole complex of ideas. The 12 kinds of fruit, okay, are considered an allusion to the trees of Ezekiel 47:12. Let me just go back and read 47:12 just so we don't lose that. So Ezekiel 47:12. Says, on the banks, on both sides of the river, there will grow all kinds of trees for food. Their leaves will not wither, nor their fruit fail, but they will bear fresh fruit every month, because the water for them flows from the sanctuary. Their fruit will be for food, and their leaves for healing, which of course is a line that's going to come up in Revelation as well. So this is Ezekiel 47. It's this eschatological, this end times vision of the restoration back in the land, so on and so forth. So it's an Edenic vision, and we get this reference to, again, all these different kinds of trees for food, and they bear fruit every month. Well, that's where the number 12 comes in. So in Ezekiel 47:12, we don't have 12 kinds of fruit, but we do have fruit every month. Of course, there's 12 months. There, the trees miraculously bear 12 different kinds of fruit, one each month, while, again, you know, you get the counterpart with Revelation 21. Again, it's the same idea, just expressed in a different way. Ezekiel 47:12 again mentions the healing of the nations. and Keener notes, to Ezekiel's healing revelation adds of the nations. So Ezekiel 47:12 just mentions healing, and John interprets that of the nations. Let me go back and just read that to you again. 47:12. Just look what John does with this. And on the banks on both sides of the river, there will grow all kinds of trees for food. Okay. And at the end, their fruit will be for food and their leaves for healing. This is Ezekiel. He's writing to the captives of Judah. Okay. It's Israel-centered. It's Jew-centered, if you will. But when John uses it in Revelation 21, guess what? It's not. John cites it and adds the phrase, the nations, healing of the nations. Again, he's just taken another Jewish prophecy and applied it to the whole church. He's applied it to believers everywhere. Again, one people of God, one source of life, one place where the Lord's going to tabernacle. And all of these ideas just coming through once again in this little section. This is kind of interesting for the Unseen Realm audience here. It's hard not to see, again, Isaiah 66, 18 through 23 in this passage. Remember, that's in Isaiah, that's where the nations are judged. We have the day of the Lord, the nations get judged, and of course, their gods with them. We have the destruction of the gods, the Psalm 82 judgment finally fulfilled, and the nations are judged. But we also have in Isaiah 66, people from the nations who worship the Lord at Jerusalem. We have Gentiles being grafted in even to the priesthood. You get both views. You get both sides of it. You get the judgment and the blessing, day of the Lord, and then the grafting in. And it's really interesting. Owen makes this comment. He says, the healing of the nations is further explained by 22:3. First, there will no longer be any curse. The phrase is taken from Zechariah 14:11. And apply to the eternal new order in which it finds its final attainment. Although for curse, the Septuagint of Zechariah has anathema, and Revelation has katathema. Both are legitimate renderings, again, in the Septuagint, of the Hebrew term kerem. Okay, this is the big conquest verb of killing. You know, the giant clans and all that, the kerem, to put things under the ban. So by virtue of this one word, you go back to Revelation 22:3. Again, just picking up, Owen picks up on this one word, and he says, if you read it, no longer will there be anything accursed. See, in this new Eden, in the new city of Jerusalem, in the new Eden, the new earth, there's no longer anything accursed. And the vocabulary that John picks is one of the terms that is often used to translate kerem in the Old Testament. The kerem is over. Okay, everything that could be put to the ban has been put to the ban. There is no more defilement. It's just that one word, there's no more kerem, is a great way to telegraph the idea of a complete, irreversible ending of chaos. Right there, just that one term. So again, if you're familiar with the Unseen Realm content and how important that term is, I thought I would throw that in. It's just, there it is. There it is. And it's right where you'd expect it to be, with a new Eden. Because before the fall, there was no kerem. There was no chaos to be reversed. There was nothing to be put under the ban. Now in verse 8, one more note here. John attempts to worship the interpreting angel, you know, at the end. So if we go down to verse 8 here, I, John, am the one who heard and saw these things, and when I heard and saw them, I fell down to worship at the feet of the angel who showed them to me. But he said to me, don't do that. You must not do that. I am a fellow servant with you and your brothers, like the your brothers the prophets, and with those who keep the words of this book. Worship God. Okay, that's verses 8 and 9. So his attempt to worship the interpreting angel gets rejected. And the same thing happens in Revelation 19:10. We didn't comment it on there, but I'm gonna read you something Beale has here, and he has it at Revelation 19:10, but then he refers, you know, here to this verse. He writes, the theme of angels refusing worship to highlight the divine source of visions and to tone down the role of mediating angels is found in other Jewish and Christian apocalyptic literature. He has examples here, the ascension of Isaiah in chapter 7 and 8, Tobit chapter 12, apocalypse of Zephaniah chapter 6, and a few others. He writes, the angel commands John not to worship him, but to worship God. Okay. The Greek grammar there is best rendered literally as see not, and is roughly equivalent to our colloquial don't, just the word don't. Another reason for the prohibition is that the angel is but a mere fellow servant of John and your brothers who hold the testimony of Jesus. This does not mean that the speaker is a glorified believer, but that through an angel, or though an angel, he is also a servant to God like John and his comrades in proclaiming the testimony of Jesus. Angels proclaim from heaven and believers from earth. There's the symbiotic relationship again, heaven and earth. Perhaps John mistook the angel for the divine figure from heaven in chapter 1, verse 13 and following, or 10, verse 1 and following, who is worthy of worship. Whatever his motive, Beale says, the prohibition stands as a warning to Christians not merely against worship of angels in particular, but against idolatry in any form in general, which was a problem among some of John's readership, at least according to his comments in Revelation 2, 14 to 15, 20 and 21, and Revelation 9, 20. But he says it's unlikely that it's a polemic against a specific cult of angel worship that existed among some Christian communities in Asia Minor. Now, there are going to be scholars who disagree with Beale there, because there is good evidence, particularly at Colossae, that this was a problem. But what do we do with this? Well, I think it makes sense that the worship, the angel rejects worship because we don't do that, and only God is worthy of worship. And so I think the idea of a polemic against worshiping angels is likely in view, just generally because of idolatry. And again, I'm going to say, I think a situation like Colossae could motivate it as well. But the issue for us is a little confusing, because we've seen a couple times earlier in the book in chapter 1, and you know more recently in Revelation 14, 14 through 20, Revelation 10, 1, we've seen that Christ is cast as an angel in a couple of verses. This is what's known academically, and you can refer to the episodes that we did on that cover Revelation 10 and Revelation 14. This is known in academic circles as angelomorphic Christology, the idea that God sometimes takes the form of a man, or i.e. an angel, like the angel of the Lord in the Old Testament. Again, when you put it that way, it's very familiar. But this is a whole category of how Christ can be portrayed. It doesn't mean that Christ is an angel. It means that one particular angel in this or that scene just so happens to be God, again, in human form from heaven, and so it gets interpreted as an angel. So since that's true, you know, we'd have to ask ourselves, well, why does he say, don't worship me, worship God? Because in the very next verse, it's sort of, well, I should say, very closely following, it seems like this is Jesus. You get down to verse 12, behold, I am coming soon, bringing my recompense with me to repay each one for what he has done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end. Now that sounds like, again, sounds like Jesus, Alpha and Omega. He says, worship God. Who else can take the label Alpha and Omega but Christ? But then he has this refusal to worship. So like, what's going on here? Now, I would suggest, you know, just my little take here. I think there's an easy path, but I'll give you the little more difficult or clunkier path first. So in Revelation 22, 13, you could read it to say that the angel identifies himself as the Alpha and Omega. You could read the passage that way. And in that case, then we're talking about Jesus. And you'd have to ask yourself, well, why refuse the worship? I would say it could be akin to Jesus' own elevation of the Father in the Gospels. For instance, he gets into a discussion with certain people who call him good, and he says, well, don't call me good, only, you know, call God good. Only God is good. You know, like he wants to elevate God juxtaposed with himself. Only God deserves, you know, this kind of language, so on and so forth, to teach the people, you know, that he is a servant of the Father. Okay, so it could be something like that. Again, the idea wouldn't be a denial of his deity or some affirmation that he was born sinful or something like that. Rather, the idea would be to keep the focus of worship and adoration on the Father. That was part of Jesus' mission. But I think there's an easier path here. I think the simplest solution is to assign or is to assume Christ is the referent of verse 13, the Alpha and Omega, and that there is an accompanying angel also in the scene or in the vision. That is, verse 8 points to an angelic interpreter, and Jesus is also present, you know, via earlier portions of the book, because this is actually just one part of a grand scene. These scenes tend to flow over multiple chapters. And so it's easy to sort of lose the characters. So I think it is quite plausible that we have an interpreting angel here and Jesus in the same scene, but that only comes out here in verses 8 and 13. And if that's the case, then it's okay for the angel, the angelic interpreter, to say, don't worship me, worship God. And Jesus is right there and refers to himself as the Alpha and the Omega. There's no problem. So I think you'd have two figures there instead of just John and one other figure. I think you have John and with two. And I think verse 16 supports that. If you read verse 16, I, Jesus, have sent my angel to testify to you about these things for the churches. I am the root and the descendant of David, the bright morning star. So I think that suggests we've got two rather than one. And as far as the morning star, our last note here, I'm going to direct readers or listeners' attention to Unseen Realm. This is a messianic title. It's messianic by its very nature. So in Unseen Realm, specifically in pages 312 and 313, I get into this real briefly. The morning star language in Revelation 2:28 is messianic. It refers to a divine being who would come from Judah. Okay. We know this by considering two other passages. In Numbers 24:17, we read the prophecy that a star will go out from Jacob and a scepter will rise from Israel. Numbers 24:17 was considered messianic in Judaism, completely apart from New Testament writers. In other words, literate readers of John's writing would have known the morning star reference was not about literal brightness or something twinkling in the sky. By the way, Matthew never quotes Numbers 24:17 about the Star of Bethlehem either. So that wasn't what the Numbers passage is about. Rather, it's about royalty. It's about the Messiah. Okay, it is about a descendant from Judah who will rise up and be divine. Okay, because this is how stars get thought of. Stars were, you know, it's a metaphor for divine beings, divine personages. And in this case, you have a divine ruler. So the wording of Revelation 2, I wrote in Unseen Realm, is especially powerful when read against this backdrop. Not only does Jesus say that he is the messianic morning star in Revelation 22:16, but earlier in the book, when he says, I will give him who overcomes the morning star, that's Revelation 2:28, he grants us the authority to rule with him as though we had the morning star. And we do. Because he gives it to us. He gives us that role, that status. So it's really about a status. You know, at the end of the book, you know, we have this wording about adding to or taking away. This will be the last thing that I mention here. And people often ask about this, and they want to say, well, this is why we should only use the King James Version in the book of Revelation, because those other versions add words or take words out. That has nothing to do with what's going on here. It's not a statement about the transmission of the Greek New Testament 1600 years before it ever happened. Okay, it has nothing to do with text versions and whatnot. Rather, Beale and McDonough note this. What is the meaning of adding to and taking away from revelatory words? The answer must be sought, believe it or not, in Deuteronomy. In Deuteronomy 4, 1 and 2, and Deuteronomy 12, 32, and I would also just throw in here Deuteronomy 29, 19, and 20. The language serves as a twofold warning against deceptive teaching that affirmed that idolatry was not inconsistent with faith in the God of Israel. That was an error. Okay, Deuteronomy 4, 1 and 2 reads this. And now, Israel, hear the ordinances and the judgments that I am teaching you to do today in order that you may live and become numerous. And after entering, take possession of the land that the Lord, the God of your fathers, is giving you. Do not add to the word that I am commanding you, and do not subtract from it. keep the commands of the Lord your God that I am commanding you today. And then later on in Deuteronomy 29, it's part of that blessing and cursing, you know, thing that, again, is about the covenant. And it talks about being wiped, you know, the name, your name wiped from the Lord's sight, you know, under heaven. But it's linked to, again, this notion of don't add or subtract. So what Beal and McDonough are going to suggest is we might want to think about this in terms of Deuteronomy, because since Deuteronomy uses this language, if you go back and reread Deuteronomy 4, 1, and 2, like we just did, you would notice in the very next verse, Deuteronomy 4, 3, it's an allusion to the Baal Peor episode of Numbers 25, 1 through 9, and 14 through 18. First Enoch quotes it the same way. Those who deceive in this way, in the way of Baal of Peor, are false prophets. Such false teaching amounts to adding to God's law, and furthermore, it is tantamount to taking away from God's law, since it violates the positive laws against idolatry. Now, Beal points out the analogy of First Enoch, and we just mentioned Enoch, you know, it deals with this too. And Beal cites First Enoch 104, verse 11, where there's a warning not to change or take away from my words, and it means that the reader should not lie. They should not take account of idols. They should not alter and pervert the words of righteousness or practice great deceits. So Beal's point in bringing up the Enoch passage, the Enoch parallel here, is when we get to the end of the book of Revelation, it's not about textual criticism. It's not about favoring one Greek manuscript tradition over another. Adding to and taking away from God's words are to lie. They are to reject and distort what the text says. And you can either do that by putting something in there that shouldn't be in there, or taking something out that should be there. And the effect of doing that, generally, is false teaching. And specifically, in Deuteronomy, it's related to the sin of what happened at Baal of Peor with Balaam, and how he, you know, how he got Israel to sin. So it's actually much clearer, it's much more specific, having to do with false teaching in general, as opposed to which, you know, which New Testament text should we use, which, you know, should we use the King James or something else? And that has nothing to do with it. It's really about obedience to the text as we have it, not inserting anything in there to get out of obedience, and not taking anything away, again, to excuse ourselves from our own sin, our own idolatry. So that is Revelation 21 and 22. Again, these are the Old Testament context. As always, you know, we could have thrown more in there and done three or four parts of this, but I hope, you know, now that we're at the end of this series, that, again, you draw the same conclusion that I wanted you to draw at the beginning, and that is there's really no New Testament book that has as much Old Testament in it as the book of Revelation. And of course, the mystery is, as we said in the very first episode of the series, you can go back and listen to it, the oddity is that John almost never quotes the Old Testament word for word. What he does is he alludes to things in the Old Testament over and over and over again. He'll do it in cycles. He'll take three or four verses and cram them together and amalgamate them, sort of merge them with each other, to make some particular point of teaching or to explain part of the vision that he saw. He will use the Old Testament almost in every line. He'll allude to something in the Old Testament, or he'll combine, you know, a couple of things that he gets from the Old Testament. He assumes that you know it so well that you'll be able to pick up, you know, what he's putting down. So he is the antidote. Really, he is the exact reverse of the impulse we see in churches today about getting away from the Old Testament or minimizing its value. I would suggest that if you're not steeped in the Old Testament, you don't have a prayer of understanding anything in the book of Revelation, period. So, you know, if you're in that kind of church context, in that church situation, I pity you. If you're following somebody who teaches that, I pity you as well. Because when it comes to the book of Revelation, it's inescapable. It's everywhere. And newsflash, Revelation's not unique. All the New Testament books get into the Old Testament. You know, none of them are quite as heavy, you know, and sort of omnipresent. You know, the Old Testament is ubiquitous in Revelation. but a lot of them have a lot to say in regard to the Old Testament. It was the Bible that Jesus had. It was the Bible the early church had before there were any of these letters and gospels written. What's the word of God to Paul before he pens a letter? It's the Old Testament. Okay? So this is how we need to work this back into our consciousness, that the things that we read in the New Testament have precedent, and that precedent is going to largely come from the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament.
A good series. Don't forget, we're still taking, you got a couple of weeks to get to your questions to me at TreyStrickland@gmail.com for our Revelation Q&A. Yep. And, we'll tackle as many as we can. Great series, Mike. Can't believe it's over. It's here. We appreciate all the hard work to get here. So,
It was a lot of work, but I learned a lot, going through it, forcing myself to go through every chapter and with an eye toward these things. So it was, you might want to edit this out, but it was well worth it for Mike to go through Revelation.
That's good. Yeah. And for us too. I mean, we all benefited. It was a good series. We appreciate everybody that voted for it. And, we've got some new series, hopefully the beginning of the year.
Oh yeah, we have plans. We have plans for opening 2022. Just trust us. We do.
Well, there you go, Mike. All right. Well, hey, congratulations on ending Revelation, and it was great. It was a good ride. We appreciate it, and I want to thank you, everybody, for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.